From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. The Deputy Attorney General of the United States has appointed a special counsel to investigate Russian interference into last year's presidential elections. The move followed President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and reports that Trump asked Comey to end the investigation into Russian ties with his campaign. Trump met Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Washington in an effort to resolve differences over the role of Syrian Kurds in the battle against the group that calls itself the Islamic State. The visit was marred by violent clashes outside the Turkish ambassador's residence between Erdogan bodyguards and people protesting Erdogan's increasingly authoritarian rule. And finally, trying to leave behind mounting controversies at home, President Trump embarked on his first major overseas trip with stops in Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the Vatican. What a week. Where do we begin? There have been so many scoops, Linda, in the New York Times and Washington Post that one media critic wrote, quote, "The two papers have been answering each other's major scoops like smitten teens volleying text messages." And others also, McClatchy Newspapers has also had a few amazing scoops. One day after another, we have heard about the Trump efforts to apparently stop the investigation into Russian ties with his campaign. And of course, now we have the fallout in the form of the naming of a special counsel to investigate those ties.
Right. And another scoop was a leaked memo from James Comey, the fired head of the FBI, in which the allegation is that Donald Trump had requested to Comey that he end the investigation into Michael Flynn.
The disgraced former National Security Advisor. Yeah.
Right. So, as you say, the news just keeps piling up and piling up. And the naming of Mueller was one of those holy bleep moments in Washington. But really, it's an event that could have been a gift to Donald Trump. What Donald Trump could have said was to say, good choice.
Yes, this is the former director of the FBI, Bob Mueller, very well respected.
Exactly. Bob Mueller was the perfect choice, impeccable credentials, high integrity, bipartisan support, and he himself is nonpartisan. So he really, as I said on Facebook, Washington is now under adult supervision.
At least in this area. Yeah.
And there was, I think, a sigh of relief when Mueller was named. But did Donald Trump use that to his advantage? No. He could have said, good choice, let's get to the bottom of this Russia thing,
right,
which he insists is a hoax and there's no there. And he could really then pivot toward his agenda. But no, he calls it a witch hunt and says it's dividing the country. So he's really sort of amped up the tension and the rhetoric and really kept himself at the center of things in a very negative way.
Indeed. David, apparently, according to Comey's notes, Trump praised Flynn as a good man and told Comey, "I hope you can let this go." I think that's going to be his epitaph, possibly. And of course, Trump then fired the head of the FBI, James Comey, using as justification a memo written, he said, by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Now we find out that the Deputy Attorney General understood that Comey was going to be fired even before he wrote this memo. Yet Trump continues to contradict himself. I think the other thing that was striking, besides his tweets about a witch hunt and so on, he said that no politician had ever been so ill-treated as he had been. And people immediately began to put on Twitter pictures of Nelson Mandela and Aung San Suu Kyi.
Abraham Lincoln being shot, things
like
that.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of retreated into this whining mode of I'm the victim, and I don't think that's going to help.
So I think that I would feel a lot of sympathy for listeners out there who are kind of losing track of what's going on. I think it's worth taking a step back and to say something very simple. We know for a fact, we know that the Russians tried to interfere in last year's election. We know that someone broke into the servers of the Democratic Party and of the Hillary Clinton campaign and released a whole bunch of stolen emails at a moment judged to be as unhelpful as possible in an attempt to interfere in the American election. And we know that the intelligence community in America thinks that it's absolutely clear that that was done by Russian military intelligence. They also have done it in France. They also did it in the Netherlands. They've been funding far-right nationalist parties across Western Europe because they have an agenda, mm-hmm. which is to keep the West divided, to cause trouble for NATO, basically to try and sort of divide and rule the Western bloc. So we know that that happened. So you can, if you're feeling kind of confused and that nothing makes any sense, cling on to that. We know that Russia attacked the American election. And then, as Linda says, it could have been so different. President Trump could have said, this awful thing happened. I knew nothing about it. My people had nothing to do with it. We need to get to the bottom of it because America was attacked and I'm America's president. And I will let this investigation run. And if I find out that Russia did it, then Russia will pay a serious price. But because President Trump, among other things, thinks that people are trying to steal his victory from him, they're trying to say that he's not really president, that he doesn't deserve to be president, that touches at his very fragile ego, and also because quite possibly there was contact between people in his campaign who were very close to the Russian government. People like Paul Manafort, who was campaign chairman for a while, people like Carter Page, who was an advisor, people like Roger Stone, who's this kind of strange, dirty tricks guy hanging around, had advanced knowledge of the emails. So there's a lot of smoke, even if there isn't fire. Mm-hmm. And the problem with Donald Trump is that his character is that he cannot let these things go. He's so vindictive. He's so vindictive that we saw several times this week White House staff doing what White House staff do, which is coming out with the kind of line to take, and we, you know, the sort of the normal response. We welcome this investigation. We want to get on with our agenda. We have busy things to do. And then, whether it's on Twitter or whether it's in a sort of self-pitying speech to Coast Guard graduates, you know, whatever the format, Donald Trump drags it back to himself because he is bitter and brooding that he's achieved this extraordinary thing, getting elected president, and still the world is wanting to kind of quibble and carp, and he cannot bear that.
Linda, we were talking before the show about the difference between a special prosecutor and a special counsel. I think a lot of people may remember the special prosecutor during the Watergate scandal. Mm-hmm. I believe there was also a special prosecutor during the Clinton administration. But the law was changed in 1999, so the special counsel, mm-hmm. he still can bring charges. Yes, he can bring criminal charges.
Absolutely.
Against people. What are the differences between the two, if any?
Well, a special prosecutor under the old law that has expired was appointed by a three-judge panel, which insulates that person from the executive branch. The current setup with a special counsel is part of the executive branch. He's part of the law enforcement wing of the executive branch. And that means that in theory, Donald Trump could fire the new special counsel, Robert Mueller. Mm-hmm. Now, Donald Trump has fired a bunch of people so far during his tenure as president. And we have this habit of Washington of cutting to the chase and going right to Watergate, mm-hmm. and making these analogies that suggest impeachment and or resignation of Trump. But I would caution that we take a deep breath and not quite go there yet. These firings are echoes, perhaps, of Watergate. But if Donald Trump were to fire Robert Mueller or attempt to fire him or ask the deputy attorney general to fire him or the attorney general for that matter, that would be beyond serious. That, I think, would really seriously ramp up impeachment talk.
Yeah. Obviously, we're not there yet, and Republicans control both houses of Congress, David, but there have certainly been more rumblings from the Republicans on Capitol Hill, tremendous concern that whatever agenda they had hoped to pass is now going to be completely unrealistic because, of course, Washington will be watching the scandal unfold every day.
That's right. And, you know, if you're an optimistic Republican in Congress, actually the appointment of this special counsel in the short term buys them time. It buys them breathing room, because now when journalists like us go up to senators and say, Senator, have you seen the latest thing that Donald Trump has said, or have you seen the latest scoop in the New York Times or the Washington Post? Now he can say, that senator, she and he can say, oh, well, there's a special counsel. I don't want to interfere in that investigation. We have to let that run its course. Let's talk about tax cuts, or let's talk about, you know, building new roads and bridges. But I think that one of the other really important things about the appointment of the special counsel, and there's not that much room for hope at the moment, the statement that was put out by Rod Rosenstein, the guy who appointed this new special counsel, talked about how the American people need to have confidence that the government can investigate itself, if you like, and that this is not part of the usual party politics, that mm-hmm. there is a kind of independent, professional machine that is capable of investigating the government. And I think that, you know, the fact that he had to spell that out is a sad reflection of just how little trust there is in the American people at the moment, that they really do feel that everything is kind of blue team or red team. You know, it's either a Democratic witch hunt or it's a Republican cover-up. And the idea of someone actually just being able to say, no, I am independently a member of the United States government investigating this, very few people, unfortunately, are willing to believe that. The guy they have appointed, Robert Mueller, he's as close, I think, as you get in this very dangerous moment to someone who commands that kind of confidence. He was appointed by George W. Bush, Republican president, took office as head of the FBI a week before the 9/11 attacks. Americans remember him as quite a reassuring, kind of commanding presence for that decade of the war on terror. He was there for 12 years.
And
Barack
Obama as well.
Kept him on for two more years. So he has that kind of bipartisan sort of credential there, that, you know, if anyone is capable of cutting through this kind of partisan, kind of witch hunt talk, hopefully it is Robert Mueller, the new special counsel.
Linda, I want to go back to the issue of Michael Flynn. This is the former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was fired by President Obama. He then went out on his own as a lobbyist, it turns out, for the government of Turkey, for the Russians. There have been some extraordinary stories suggesting that the White House knew he was under investigation for being an unregistered lobbyist for Turkey when he was appointed National Security Advisor. And then one scoop in McClatchy newspapers saying that Flynn persuaded the outgoing Obama administration not to go forward with a campaign against Raqqa in Syria using Syrian Kurds, which, of course, is something that the Turks are vehemently opposed to. Right. And that this all happened while he was on a $500,000 retainer from someone very close to the Turkish president. Trump still calls Flynn a good guy. He apparently is still in contact with him. What explains this bond between Trump and Flynn? Is it simply a matter of loyalty? Is it that they share a benign view of Russia? What is it?
Well, it's hard to know what's going on in Donald Trump's head, but we do know that his personal relationships are very important to him. And when he hits it off with somebody, he will stay loyal to them and he will almost cling to them. I mean, Mike Flynn is somebody who has long experience in the military and actually was a quite respected figure for a time before things went south and Obama fired him. But they just have, I guess, a chemistry or something. But as you say, Trump, he can't let go. I mean, I think part of it is that Trump is feeling besieged and needs that kind of comfort of people that he trusts.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. David, I want to move on, but I wonder if you have any other thoughts about this mind meld between Trump and Flynn. I mean, Flynn is going to bring Trump down, it seems. Flynn obviously had many contacts with the Russians, with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, before the inauguration. It seems that Trump must have known about this, I guess.
So I think there's two things going on. One is, you know, when he was considered a joke as a candidate, Flynn was one of the first very sort of senior figures who went to him, who joined him on the campaign trail. That matters a lot in Trump world because they feel that they have all these people who jumped on the bandwagon very late and now claim to be best friends, but they're not to be trusted because they only came on when it was easy. So the people who came on when it was hard and it was a small team, they have a special bond. There's part of that. I think there's also a policy mind meld, which is Mike Flynn, more than any other figure in that administration, represented the idea that there was this grand bargain that you could forge between America and the Russians. If you asked people about it, it was not a particularly sophisticated idea. It was basically that America wants to destroy the Islamic State, but doesn't want to waste American money and doesn't want to risk American lives. The Russians also have a problem with radical Islam. They're much less squeamish about civilian casualties. They don't care if they, you know, bomb civilians when they're fighting terrorists. They're much tougher, they're much rougher. And so somehow, if you could outsource some of the fighting to the Russians in places like Syria, that would be a kind of win-win. And then if the price of that was letting the Russians take, you know, chunks of Ukraine, well, you know, who cares, because Ukraine is their backyard. It's a kind of a spheres of influence, mm-hmm. kind of extremely cynical kind of realpolitik way of viewing the world, that there are a few large countries, they have spheres of influence, and you should let them do what they want in their backyard. And then if they want to be rougher and tougher and kill some terrorists, then all to the good. And that was definitely the Mike Flynn kind of view, very much focused on this is a kind of global civilizational war with Islam, mm-hmm. and we need all the allies we can get. And Russia is a tough, rough, Christian nationalist ally in that fight.
Yeah, yeah. Another piece of this is that the new national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, he and Trump do not mesh. McMaster, very respected military figure. For example, he doesn't believe that Trump should use the words radical Islamic terrorism and advised him not to go there. And when Trump gave his speech to Congress a few months ago, not only did Trump use those words, he really emphasized them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and we keep hearing rumblings. I mean, everybody's about to get fired in the White House, right? But we, so McMaster is one of those people that, you know, has perhaps one foot out the door, but...
I don't know if he, I mean, how many people can he fire?
Well, he can't, I know, I mean, he could bring in, we could wind up with Trump 2.0, and he could kick out everybody except his daughter and son-in-law and bring in a new team, and then they wouldn't work either.
I was going to talk about Turkey, but let's segue, actually, because you raised the issue of radical Islamic terrorism, so-called. Trump is going on his first foreign trip. His first stop is Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. David. And apparently Stephen Miller, who is one of the most Islamophobic members of the administration, someone who wrote the initial executive order that sought to ban people from 7 majority Muslim countries from coming to this country. Apparently, he's the lead author on the speech on Islam that Trump is going to deliver in Saudi Arabia. The potential for missteps seems huge here, although the Saudis seem delighted that Trump is Trump and sort of willing to give him a pass just because he's not Obama.
I spoke to the Saudis actually this week about it. So they're very, very happy with him. One is he's not Obama, and that means a couple of things. One is they have their own fights and their own wars in say, Yemen, and so they like the fact that Donald Trump basically is not that fussed about civilian casualties, and he's not fussed about human rights, and he's not going to nag them on that stuff.
Women's rights, yeah.
Women's rights, you know, all of that. There's also a lot of this is about Iran, subject that you know a great deal about. There was this belief, which was partly rooted in the reality of the Iran nuclear deal that was Barack Obama's top priority in that region, partly, I think, something of a kind of sectarian sort of hysteria, that somehow Barack Obama was in favor of Shia Islam, in favor of the Iranians, and anti-Sunni, and anti the sort of Sunni Arab Gulf states, that he had somehow chosen a side. Now, Obama people would tell you that's nuts. They, of course, didn't choose a side between Sunni and Shia. They had no desire to, no need to. But that was very strongly the perception. And so because Donald Trump has a lot of time for Sunni Arab strongmen who are willing to crush radical Islam in their own countries.
And buy a lot of American weapons.
And buy huge amounts of American weapons. So he likes, for example, President al-Sisi in Egypt, former military guy, basically a military dictator. He has a lot of time for the Gulf Arab monarchs. And the Saudis basically are putting on this gigantic show. They have, I think, 50 heads of government and state going to greet him in Saudi Arabia. It's going to be a sort of short speech. We're told that it's going to be about a peaceful vision for Islam. But I think from the perspective of the White House, what do they want? They want people in America to see America is strong. Trump is not apologizing for America as they say Barack Obama did. The Saudis are going to spend a ton of money buying American-made weapons and ships and things, and that's going to be jobs in America. So it's basically the kind of the un-Obama, anti-Obama tour.
Yeah, of course, Obama sold hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons to the Saudis, too, lest we forget. Linda, you know, what do you make of this trip? There's talk of an Arab NATO, some references I've seen that this group of Arab countries, many of them assembled there in Riyadh, will be forming some sort of an alliance in which the U.S. will provide some sort of backing, and I guess it's largely to be opposed to Iran. There's already the Gulf Cooperation Council, which serves that function. So is this just kind of more atmospherics? I mean, these are countries that do not have the capabilities of NATO allies, and many of them, even we've seen from the war in Yemen, that the Saudis don't even have ground forces that are capable of fighting very well. So is this just more sort of smoke and mirrors?
Right. I mean, I actually hadn't heard about this Arab NATO issue, but it's a potentially very consequential
trip. He's visiting, for starters, the three countries that are central to three major religions in the world, Catholicism, Islam, and Judaism, a meeting with Mahmoud Abbas on the side in Bethlehem, you know, the G7.
Yes, I left that out as well. He's going to Brussels
right. NATO's in Brussels, and G7 is in Sicily.
In Sicily,
in Italy,
right.
Meeting the Pope in Rome. This could be a symbolically very important trip if he can watch his mouth. And it's not even what he says publicly, it's also what he says privately to these world leaders. They're all going to be taking the measure of each other.
Sure.
And he'll be meeting with Macron, the new French president. They're having a lunch. This is really big. I mean, obviously, we don't know what's going to happen, but this will really, I think, sort of set the stage and the tone for Trump's leadership on the world stage and his relations on the world stage going forward.
You know, David, I think a lot of world leaders are going to be sort of walking on eggshells with him, right? Worried that they might antagonize him in some way and very uncertain about what's going to happen to him.
So I think one of the kind of striking and slightly dismaying things is if you talk to diplomats who are involved in actually preparing some of these meetings, they have no illusions that this is a kind of, you know, great geopolitical statesman who's ready to kind of engage with all of these leaders. They're all aware that the man has a very short attention span. They talk about him as though he's basically a kind of bored child or a child with attention deficit disorder, as someone described him as. So they know that they've been told, okay, we need to make sure that all the meetings are really short, that he doesn't have to listen to too many speeches. We have to make sure that he gets to take the credit for some big successes. So he has to be given things all the time that are about him. And so these leaders know what they're dealing with is not a regular guy. And we in Washington have to also understand, we may think that this is shocking and deplorable, embarrassing, but the American people chose this. They knew what they were electing. They were electing someone who wasn't a regular politician, who was going to be crude and coarse and ignorant and brash and aggressive. That's what they wanted. The American people, a plurality, elected fair and square someone who was going to be completely different. And I think we in Washington can see the damage that then causes. We in Washington may be embarrassed by this. But out in America, where most people live, Trump's country thinks this is fantastic. This is exactly what they want. And the fact that the French foreign minister thinks that Donald Trump's ignorant, they don't care.
Yeah, no, actually, that could improve his image in some places. Before we leave this week, I did want to mention something that happened in Washington that was really quite unusual, even by the standards now of the Trump administration, Linda, and that is the visit of the Turkish president, speaking of authoritarian figures. He had a short, relatively uneventful meeting with Trump, but outside the Turkish ambassador's residence, there was a melee, and Erdogan bodyguards really beat up protesters who were there in quite a hideous way, to the point that John McCain, a senator, has called for the Turkish ambassador to be expelled. Some of these bodyguards apparently had done something similar a year ago when Erdogan came outside the Brookings Institution.
Oh, wow.
And they're hiding behind diplomatic immunity to carry this out. I just wondered if you had any particular thoughts on this incident.
Well, it's obviously outrageous, and I credit VOA for getting a really good video of that and putting that online so that people can see for themselves what happened. I mean, it's really shocking. I mean, this is thuggish behavior, unbecoming of any country, but in this country, we value free speech and the right to stand in front of an ambassador's residence and say what you think, even if this opinion, I guess it was Kurds.
Primarily Kurds, yes.
Protesting, and obviously shocking. And I would add that in Donald Trump's meeting in the Oval Office with President Erdogan, the issue of human rights did not come up. There was a lot of disappointment in Trump's handling of that meeting and even of giving him that Oval Office treatment, which is, you know, aplomb for any world leader. I just think it's just sad.
Yeah, apparently the only thing in terms of human rights that was raised was the issue of an American pastor who's been jailed in Turkey, but no mention of thousands of people who've been purged, the many reporters who are in jail or anything like that. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.